Afro-American newspaper, black newspaper in Baltimore City. Front page has a syndicated piece that's running in hundreds of newspapers all over the country. It says, "Plays African Death Machine." And it's got this paragraph that's like, "In the dead of night, there's a process by which this instrument is made in a secret thing that no woman can see or she'll be put to death." And it's called the Ochi Sanji, this instrument. And this instrument that, you know, is so dangerous and scary and everything, was played by a white woman the other night at a talk. Can you believe it? And it's, you know, like Tarzan shit. Because that's all America knows about Africa. It's Tarzan movies and books. And then Laura Bolton, the next paragraph, is just her saying, what's amazing is that West Africans have forgotten more about rhythm than we, Westerners, have ever known. Their technology is so far advanced. And just as our symphonies and sonatas are made from folk dances and court dances, so too, in the future, our music may be made of African dances. In 1937, she was a prophet. And this is in Jim Crow America, where black people were radically segregated, suppressed, humiliated constantly. When Laura Bolton was born in 1900, there were still 3,000 people in the United States who had been born in Africa and brought over against their will. It was in living memory, the institution of slavery in America. And here's Laura Bolton, this smiling 30-something white woman going like, well, this is just the best music, isn't it? Listen to it, listen to how, da-da-da, you know, playing these recordings. So she spends the next couple of years going around touring, giving talks, playing things, not unlike what I'm doing now. She has taken some classes at the University of Chicago in anthropology, but she invents her way of doing ethnological work for profit by herself. And she convinces RCA Victor Records to put out a 6-disc album drawn from these hundreds of recordings that she made in 1934. It comes out at the end of 1939. It is, like her lectures, unfortunately titled Rhythms in the Jungle. She wasn't anywhere near a goddamn jungle, and she knew it, but she also was meeting people on their level and knew that that's what everybody expected, was jungle, 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 jungle. And this record is not at all hard to find in the US. It was issued in 1939. But before I talk about that, I gotta tell you that end of 1939, the record comes out. Beginning of 1940, after 15 years together, Rudyard leaves her. And she's 40 years old. And you know, women couldn't have a line of credit. They couldn't own a house in America until 1975. So everything is disrupted for her. Not only did somebody just throw her away, but now what the hell is she gonna do? And she says that she had known a couple of very intelligent women who had fallen to pieces when their lives were similarly disrupted, but that she was determined not to do that. So what she does, she finds out there's a conference in Mexico City on Indian music. And she gets some money from a friend who's a donor at the Metropolitan Museum. She goes to this conference and sits and listens and thinks about what her next move is gonna be. And she moves into a hotel, which is right across the street from the painter Diego Rivera. Another person staying at the same hotel, okay, you get your Hollywood gossip now for the evening, was Paulette Goddard, who was then married to Charlie Chaplin, and the two of them had just finished The Great Dictator, that movie. Paulette Goddard was there to get her portrait painted by Diego Rivera and to go to bed with him. That was like a thing that women were doing at the time, was like, you go get your portrait painted by Rivera and you sleep with him and it's a lot of fun. You should try it sometime. So that's what she was there for. It so happens that Rivera and Frida Kahlo were at the time separated because the year previous to that, Leon Trotsky had been staying in their house and Frida Kahlo and Leon Trotsky had been sleeping together. And Rivera didn't like that and he kicked Trotsky out. Laura Bolton shows up in the middle of this mess, trying to heal her own broken heart during her divorce in April 1940. The end of May 1940, Lenin gets guys to fire 137 bullets into Trotsky's house, trying to assassinate him unsuccessfully for a second time. And Diego Rivera, because he had kind of a history with Trotsky, was worried the cops were going to come after him. So Paulette Goddard puts Diego Rivera on a plane and flies him to California, and he finishes the portrait there, as a matter of fact. While Laura Bolton is staying at this hotel, she messes around with these pre-Columbian instruments that Rivera has in his studio, in his house. So this is her messing around with one of them, and that's him talking while he's painting Paulette Goddard's portrait. And this little nothing of a thing comes out on a record set that she puts out the end of 1940. She immediately begins touring around and talking and telling people about Indian music in Mexico. Because then she goes to Puebla and she records Yaqui musicians. She's very impressed with that stuff. She meets up with some people in Taos, New Mexico, who take her around, including introducing her to the Yaqui diaspora. Yaqui people had been forced into conscripted labor a couple of decades earlier, and a lot of them, thousands, had fled to the United States and had been, for a generation or two generations, removed from the homeland. She then plays the Yaqui people in the United States recordings of their brothers and sisters back home and sees people break down weeping at the wish to go back and knowing that they're stranded here in America. So here's one of those Yaqui recordings that Laura Bolton made in 1940. Oh, the sound issue is really a problem. Oh dear, oh dear. Sure, I'm sorry. Can we maybe try and sort this out? Guys, will you give me about 90 seconds, I hope, is all it'll take. But something must be done. I'm not sure, but we seem to have... it's clipping very badly when I turn it up to its audible level. Maybe if we just turn up the volume on the soundboard significantly, that'll solve the problem. So if I'm not having to turn it up on the soundboard, on the mixer here. So let's say this is baseline, and what happens if we crank it? Does it sound good? There we go. Does that sound pretty good to you guys, like at the right level? It's okay? Okay, so this Yaqui Pascola, traditional dance. So, she puts out these two albums of American Indian music from Mexico and Arizona and New Mexico, and then immediately gets a commission from the government of Canada to record Canadian music, and she spends the rest of her life, 40, 50 years, going around 38 trips, learning stories, gathering music, and then giving it back to the world. The African Indian albums she licenses to Folkways Records in the 1950s, and they were the only way you could hear African music at all in the United States for decades. You guys had, you know, all these European ethnologists who were going to the colonies and gathering stuff up and releasing it on a bunch of different labels. We didn't have that. If you went to a library in the United States, let's say you're Ahmed Abdul Malik, in 1955, the bass player for Thelonious Monk's band, and you want to hear African music, the only thing there is to hear is Laura Bolton's record. So she had lasting influence. Her work did matter to people. It was the way that people began to understand African music in the United States. I'll play you one of the African recordings. It is, of course, now fashionable, this whole thing of West African, Mauritanian, Western Saharan, Malian music guitar bands. You guys have seen Mdou Mokhtar and all these fantastic, really, really good. Here's a Tuareg guy recorded in 1934 by Laura Bolton. Incidentally, her archive, well, I'll tell you that story in a second. There, you can hear it. So when the records come out, and they have these stupid titles like Rhythm in the Jungle, they also, you know, it was the at the time, you didn't say where it was recorded, you didn't say when it was recorded, you didn't say the name of the performer, and in this case, she retitled some of the pieces. And I know this because her papers, her archives, hundreds of thousands of recordings, tens of thousands of feet of film, tens of thousands of photographs, hundreds of thousands of pages of documentation were split up under to a bunch of different archives. There's one in Arizona. There's the University of Illinois. I forgot the name of the town. But in fact, in that town, I went and I gave a talk in a bar, and it's big ethnomusicology department at UIndiana. And a woman came up to me afterward, I was smoking a cigarette, and she says, you know there's a Laura Bolton chair here in the ethnomusicology department. I said, no, I didn't know that, that's very interesting. I knew that some of her papers were here. And she said, yeah, I am that chair. I'm the Laura Bolton scholar here, and I didn't know anything about her until you talked about her. Nothing, right? She is not thought of anymore. She was forgotten. Most of her work went to Columbia University in 1961, when she was in her kind of early 60s. The process actually took several years, 61, 2, 3, 4, 5. They took it because she had a friend who was in his 80s, who was a millionaire, and said, I'll give Columbia $5 million if you give Laura Bolton a title and $10,000 a year out of a trust, and you buy her collection. So the guy who is now in charge of Laura Bolton's material at Columbia hates her, describes her as venal, and does an imitation of her when he lectures about her, where he makes her sound like a combination of Julia Child and Miss Piggy. Because he's he thinks all of this, it's undercooked, I think is how he would describe it. I think he and I are basically on the same side. His specialty is Native Alaskan stuff, and he's mostly interested in repatriating these old recordings to indigenous people. Good work, very important. But the reason that, he really doesn't like her. There could be lots of reasons for it. But there are problems with her work. For instance, some of the archives went to the Library of Congress. That's not that far away from where I live. I called them up. I said, I'm looking for any Laura Bolton material from before 1940. Oh, no, we won't have anything that early. No, I'm afraid not. I mean, you're welcome to come look, Ian, but, we'll show you whatever we've got. Great, cool, fine. I go, wheel out boxes, open the boxes, take out files, right away. Full typed out documentation of every single recording session for both the African trips and for the Native American trips in the Southwest and Mexico. There it all is. Very often artist names, very often titles, very often lyrics in the language, very often translations of the lyrics, and they're all in order by date. So all the documentation we need is just there waiting for somebody to get around to looking for it, and nobody is. So because of that, I know that that song that we just heard, which is credited on the label of the record as War Song, the title was given Ya'ali by the singer at the time. Unfortunately, she didn't note the singer's name and that recording in Timbuktu. Okay, so forgetting is the main thing that I'm kind of interested in with this whole business of America. American folklorists were very interested in preserving African-American material, and they really patted themselves on the back for that, and documenting American Indian stuff. American Folklore Society, that was their main sort of project at the end of the 19th century. The first president of the American Folklore Society was Francis James Child. Everybody know who Francis James Child was? Raise your hand. Oh yeah, a couple people. We have some good, folky nerds in here. Good. It's a child ballad. That phrase comes from this five-volume set he published at the end of the 19th century, where for decades he worked to gather text sources of British ballads. And that big masterpiece, amazing footnotes, by the way, that show that 90-something percent of the work that he was drawing from was work that was published in the past two decades before his own. But he was also looking at material in lots and lots and lots of European languages, tracing the migration of topics of songs and verses of songs and themes of songs, trying to look through these texts into the past and into migration. But he said describing the confluence of races that occurs here in the United States. Now, when Child publishes this important big set of ballads from Great Britain, the big popular music in the United States at the time was blackface minstrelsy, and had been not just for 30 years or 50 years, it had been for 100 years, since the very end of the 18th century. Americans had been, white people, I should say, in America, had been going to where black people were living, and picking up instruments, picking up styles, picking up bits of songs and themes of songs, and then getting up and covering their faces with burnt cork to reduce an entire people to just its skin color, and getting up and playing a version of black music, including on an instrument called the banjo, which subsequently became kind of associated with country music, with bluegrass and all these things. Totally African technology, like on the track we just heard, recorded in Timbuktu, right? Right. So Child's project was in fact in opposition to a ongoing blending of races that was happening culturally in America. Right at the same time, there was a guy named Mercer, who was an archaeologist, artist guy, and he was gathering originally Native American tools in archaeological digs, and then he realized there are all these other tools that had been made for a couple of hundred years in Pennsylvania, where he was, that were also in the process of going away as America became industrialized. As people moved off the farms into the cities to go work in factories, nobody made these tools anymore. So he built this collection of hundreds of thousands of tools, and then he built a museum to show them in, and to demonstrate what was as opposed to what the world we live in now, like a vanishing America, right? That's also kind of what Child was doing, was a kind of vanishing thing, a preservation process. It didn't really get important until a couple of decades later. There was a woman who was a missionary from Boston, educated woman. She and her husband went down to the Southern Appalachian Mountains to do missionary work. And while she was there, she noticed that the songs that were being sung were the same goddamn songs that are in the Child Ballads book. And she started collecting them, writing them down. And she showed them to Cecil Sharp, this British folklorist. And 1917, they publish a book of songs from the Southern Appalachians, which is when people realize that all these British ballads had been preserved by these like conservative hillbillies that had been brought over from a place called Ulster. You see, in Pennsylvania in the 18th century, the power structure, the main people in power were Quakers, and they were pacifists. It was against their religion to fight. So they couldn't kill any Indians. So they got the Scots-Irish, these Presbyterians, who were noted for being hardy and able to fight, to come over and settle the western frontier, which was basically the Appalachian Mountains, to kill Indians for them. 100,000 of them they brought over for that purpose. And the Scots-Irish stayed in the mountains, God, guts, and guns, very little regard for the cosmopolitan port city, you know, folk, and they just stayed there, and they kind of held on to the old ways. Cultural conservatism at its best, including all these old songs, right? And that becomes the basis of part of this idea of country and Western music. There's the image of the cowboy, right? Denim shirt, the Western hat, frontier man, cowboy. And then there's the hillbilly, who's this God, guts, and guns guy who's like, you know, in overalls. You put those two together, and in the middle of the 20th century, they start marketing that as country and Western. It's an idea of America. So the Child Ballad stuff then becomes influential on, well, Child was a professor at Harvard. He's an English professor. And he's the head of the American Folklore Society. 30 years later, another guy to become president of the American Folklore Society was a guy who was born in Louisiana and raised in Texas. He was born in 1864, raised in Texas, and he got interested in cowboy songs. Just liked them, and just started collecting when he was a teenager, and he kept going and going and going, and he would show them to people in academia, and they would all go, "What are you wasting your time for with this nonsense?" And he finally, 1906, he makes it up to Harvard, and Kitteridge, who followed Child as the head of the English department there, said, "Yeah, good, you should do this. You should totally do this. Keep doing this." He publishes a book of cowboy songs. That book gets famous, and Carl Sandburg sees it, who's this poet and journalist, and he publishes his own book called The American Song Bag, which is minstrel songs next to cowboy songs, next to blues, next to Tin Pan Alley. It's the whole thing of America in this American song bag. That book makes its way to a hyper-literate kid up in the Pacific Northwest named Harry Smith. Harry Smith also gets his hands on a mimeographed list. Oh, I didn't say the name of the guy who was collecting these cowboy songs. His name is John Lomax. And what happened to John Lomax is during the Depression, he went to work for a bank back down south. The bank failed, and his wife died, and he didn't know what to do with himself. And his kids said, well, why don't you go back to that thing you love? And the Library of Congress had just started a folklore center. So they drive out to the folklore center, and they say, we have an idea for a project going around the South collecting songs. And they said, well, that could be very good. Tell you what, we'll give you a disc cutting machine if you promise that you'll just give us all the recordings. Great. So John and Alan Lomax, through the 1930s into the 40s, start recording all this stuff around the South. Wide variety of stuff, a lot of, you know, black stuff going to prisons. One of the people they record in the prisons is this guy, Huey Leadbetter, Leadbelly. One of the songs that Leadbelly records in 1937 gets picked up in 1955 by a guy in England. All right, jump cut. After the Second World War, the whole generation in England who went through the war just wanted some peace and quiet, goddammit. Just please, let us just live quietly and get off rationing and go about our lives and no more bombs and no more strife and no more struggle. And it was boring to their children, who by the time they're 10, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, want to have some fucking fun. And their way of doing that was this primitive jazz that they find out about, and they call it skiffle. And so, for instance, a band of working class teenagers in Liverpool call themselves the Quarrymen as a skiffle band, later renamed themselves the Beatles. They're interested in this primitive jazz that's coming out on records performed by people like Lonnie Donegan, who performs Rock Island Line, that had been recorded by the Lomaxes in 1937 in a prison. John Lomax dies. Alan Lomax just takes up his work and does things like 1940 prints up a mimeographed list of 250 actual folk songs that were being released by the major record companies in the United States. This list makes its way out to this hyper-literate kid who had already been interested in Indian music and had been recording Indian music in the Northwest named Harry Smith. Smith studies anthropology for like one semester, and then he moves down to be like a stoned beatnik weirdo filmmaker in San Francisco, and he has access, he's starting to collect blues records because he's interested in anything that is exotic in relation to mainstream culture. Anything that's weird, according to rich people, he wants some of that. So he collects Trinidadian music, Romanian music, all the Japanese people who had been interned in the prison camps as possible enemies during the Second World War. They left all their records behind. Harry Smith is buying up thousands of those. He's buying all kinds of stuff. He builds up a collection of 20,000 discs. By 1950. Then he decides to move to New York City because he wants to get into the, you know, he's a bebop guy. He wants to go see Thelonious Monk, Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, and he wants to go make movies out there, and he needs money. He only takes 10% of his record collection, 2,000 records, the 2,000 best, he thinks. And he goes up to a guy named Moses Ash. Moses Ash had just founded a third record label. He had had two labels before that, Ash and Disc, which just crashed and burned, bankrupted both labels. He starts up this third new label called Folkways in 1949, 50, under his secretary's name, because he was by law forbidden to own another business because he'd crashed the others. Anyway, Harry Smith goes to Moses Ash and says, do you want to buy my record collection of very important folk music? Since what Moses Ash wanted to do was to present the whole world on record. And Mo Ash says, no, I don't really need to buy the records, but why don't you make an album for me of stuff from this collection? So very quickly, basically just one weekend, largely under the influence of peyote, Harry Smith knocks out six LPs of the best stuff from his collection. He actually starts off the first volume with five ballads from the child set in order in which they had appeared in the child anthology. So it's a direct reference. And he has already had the Lomax list of folk music on commercial records. He builds this thing. It's entirely from 1926 to 32, this kind of like golden era of recording that happened right after the microphone was invented. So this comes out in 1952, and it gets sold to libraries, and it just sits there for a bunch of years. Nobody thinks about it. And then, 1960, Alan Lomax puts out a book called Folk Music of North America, which is staff notation, guitar chords, lyrics to all these big important folk songs. And the people who are already these college-educated guys wearing work shirts and boots and belts, and these like earnest young women with ironed long black hair who are playing guitar and singing folk songs as like a leftist statement, folk dicks. Those people get this book, and they all learn Barbara Allen and these cowboy songs and House Carpenter from the Lomax books. And in the back of the Lomax book, there's one page called Discography that just tells you where to get records of the good stuff. And it mentions the Harry Smith set. And in big capital letters, in these three paragraphs, it says, you should also be paying attention to the electric music going on in Chicago right now, including, big caps, Little Walter and Muddy Waters. So the skiffle kids in England, who had already been through skiffle and then Chuck Berry, Elvis Presley, the Everly Brothers, rock and roll. That happens sort of from 55 to 59. That dies out. The hit parade is just pretty boy assholes. And they're like, no, we want the real stuff. And you get these middle class record collectors who are getting discs of like Chicago blues imported specifically for them in 1961, 62. Story goes, one of these guys in London, architecture student, business student, is walking out, he's got a Muddy Waters record under his arm, and another guy goes, where'd you get that? Oh, I had it shipped over from America. And the guy that comes over to him is Keith Richards, and the guy that is coming out of the store is Mick Jagger. And Keith Richards says, oh, I know a guy who knows all about this stuff, you should meet him, Brian Jones. So they form a band named after Muddy Waters, and they call the Rolling Stones. And then, a couple of years later, those bands all come to the United States right when Martin Luther King Jr. writes Why We Can't Wait, right in the middle of the civil rights struggle, when the same generation of young Americans has been living in de facto segregation and wants civil rights. And these big brothers from England are playing black music in a way that's safe, where they don't have to cross that painful line where nobody's going to shame them or humiliate them for listening to this music. You can listen to black American vernacular music now played by The Who and The Beatles and The Rolling Stones. And it is a cataclysm. And you've got Bob Dylan and Paul Simon both go over to England in 1961, where they meet Martin Carthy, who has been a skiffle kid, but is now studying folk music and ballads. And they go, oh, you could do that. Cool, right, great. So, 55 to 65, this generation defines itself on this little canon of material. And everything that has preceded that rock and roll, they start picking apart and analyzing and looking for the roots and looking for the origins and looking for the, and that all becomes cool, including Lomax, including Harry Smith. Now, by that time, Harry Smith gives an interview where he says, well, I completely reject that thing that I did, that anthology of American folk music, that record set, that whole way of doing things. I mean, I'm way past that now. Okay, I told you there was going to be a whole lot of talking. So, yeah. Then we get to, there's all these guys who get real into collecting the 78s, right? The old stuff. There's a generation of collectors that comes up. One of them is a kid in Washington, D.C., who trains as a librarian named Dick Spotswood, and he is one of these guys that starts up a little independent record label to put out things that he thinks are interesting. And he helps rediscover Mississippi John Hurt, and he puts out a record of very early instances of 12-string guitar on blues records. So he gets noticed by the Library of Congress people near Washington, you know, in Washington, D.C., and they ask him in 1975 to produce a centennial set of American folk music. And he works on that for years and years and years. But he has already, in 1971, read an article written by a Finnish researcher in American vernacular music named Pekka Granau. Anybody know Pekka Granau? He's still alive. Changed the world. Pekka Granau is the person who first realized that in the early 20th century, at the same time or before all of that country jazz blues stuff was being recorded in the United States that became the basis of Americana, the loamy roots music of early America from the 20s, right? There was already tons of stuff recorded by all these immigrants. It turns out both of the major record labels, Victor and Columbia, in 1908, began trying to market material to the largest wave of immigrants in U.S. history. Between 1880 and 1920, 25 million people arrived in the United States, and the foreign-born population of the country was about 14%. It so happens that the foreign-born population of the United States right now is about 14%. But what happened? So they start recording the immigrants, and there's a great deal to say about that. But America sort of has three major ideas about what the immigrant means to American culture. The first one, dominant thing, is Anglo-assimilation. Like, when you arrive to America as an immigrant, you should become as much like the descendants of the Protestant British colonists in the early 17th century, adopting the language, customs, clothes quickly as possible, and getting rid of any of the past, the old world. Get rid of that. Become capital A American by imitating those who are the dominant power structure, these WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. The other idea that gets talked about is the melting pot, which is the idea that when people come, elements of their culture will sift in, their language, their ways of thinking, their sensibilities will filter into the rest of the culture, and the elements of the dominant culture. Way, and the fact of us building a society together, despite different ways of doing things, different sensibilities, different religious practices, different whatever, that fact of building a society despite being so different is going to be what the American project is. That's going to be Americanness. So all three of those ideas are operating in different ways at different times, beating one another out. They really came to a head in 1924. 1920, there's a big hit song in the United States. Easier than playing it for you, I'll sing you a little bit. The first verse is the history lesson that all school children in America have basically ever gotten. Columbus discovered America in 1492. Then came the English and the French, the Scotsman and the Jew. Then came the Dutch and the Irishman to help the country grow. And still they keep on coming. Now everywhere you go, it's the Argentines and the Portuguese, the Armenians and the Greeks. It's about this anxiety about the fact that America is changing color. It's getting darker, browner, more Catholic, yet different, exotic. There are no Argentinians, by the way, came during this period. None, zip, zero. Argentina had its own massive inward wave. It's a substitute word for something that might have offended people, like Spanish, Mexican, Italian. A third of that 25 million people between 1880 and 1920 were from southern Italy. Another third were from Eastern Europe, Slavs, and Ashkenazi Jews. And another third from a wide variety of elsewhere. But it's a lot of people, and it looks strange to this dominant WASP culture. The song happens to have been written by two Jews. Anyway, later on in the song, you wind up with ideas that somehow these immigrants, they're the ones collecting the rent. They've got all the nice cars. They're doing real well. What's going on? How come they've got all this? Oh, and what about my girlfriend? What if she likes them better? What if we get married and we have a kid and the kid comes out looking like one of them and I'll know what she's been doing? Hey, sexual anxiety, right? Oh, and then there's some versions that have accusations of them all being alcoholics during Prohibition. They all love their liquor. They don't give a nickel for the stuff that runs in rivers, brooks, and creeks. And then when it ends, well, there's the Argentines and the Portuguese, the Armenians and the Greeks. They don't know the language, they don't know the law, yet they vote in the country of the free. Now the funny thing, when we start to sing, my country 'tis of thee. None of us know the words but the Argentines and the Portuguese and the Greeks. Ambivalent, because they're clearly trying to be American, and yet, God damn it, if I know what American is, they're not. And here they are trying, are we really going to let them? And then the last verse is always, you go to heaven and it's overcrowded because they're all there. So we have a common fate at least, but they're still making life uncomfortable for the rest of us, just like in the subway. So, I mean, the North American continent was originally divided among three empires, right? French, Spanish, British. Two of those are Catholic, and they didn't let any Jews in at all. And then one of them, the British one, let in all these Dutch Sephardic Jews who became this class, the Grandees, very important founding fathers in New York City, friends of George Washington, of Hamilton. The Sephardic Jews from Holland founded synagogues in 12 of the 13 colonies by the time of the Revolution. They became part of America. It was illegal to be Catholic. You'd be fined, your rights would be taken away, property taken away, you could be jailed, you could be legally killed for being found to be praying as a Catholic in the United States before the Revolutionary War. George Washington spoke direct. One of the causes of the war was the fact that King George was going to allow full rights for Catholics in Toronto, in Canada. It was just another example of George's tyranny and not consulting the Americans. But anyway, they didn't like that. They didn't want Catholics. And that remained the case for a long time. So the next big waves of immigration that happen after the Revolutionary War are German speakers, Prussians, come over. 3 million of them, or five, I'm sorry, 5 million. Oh, some of whom, by the way, years ago, still don't drive cars, still practice their religion the same way, refuse to incorporate the core American values of individualism, of commercialism, of property, buying things and selling things. And they're called the Amish and the Mennonites. Imagine if they were Muslims who stuck to the old ways and spoke the language. Imagine. right? But the Protestants from Switzerland. And they speak German with exactly my accent. I am literally from like almost one county over, northern Delaware to Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Anyway, so yeah, so you get the Germans, and then, oh God damn it, the fucking Irish come over, right? 5 million of them, and that becomes this huge problem. The city where I live, Baltimore, was a Catholic stronghold. It was a place where Catholicism was tolerated. But the Irish move in, and nativism takes over in the 1850s. Election days, 1854, 5, 6, 7, 8. Open gunfire for hours. Dozens of people murdered, hundreds of people badly wounded in open gunfire, while gangs, street gangs, hired by the nativist parties, terrorize the Catholic immigrants. And by doing this, they won those elections over and over again. It worked. Names of the gangs, by the way, pretty good. Blood Tubs, Rip Raps, Plug Uglies. These guys ran Baltimore for a while. It's a good thing Baltimore doesn't have a reputation as a violent, ugly place now. You've seen The Wire. Anyway, Lord. So that brings us to the next wave of immigrants who wind up, you know, again, being Catholic, Orthodox, Jewish, da-da-da-da-da. Big wave of anxiety, another wave of nativism. 1924, you've got the Argentines, the Portuguese, and the Greeks, recorded by 7 different artists in 2 years, recorded by, performed by hundreds of artists. There's a British version of it, 2 recordings in Great Britain. It really speaks to what the feeling is at the moment. And what winds up happening is that a law is passed for immigration called the Johnson-Reed Act, the quota system. Anybody heard of the quota system for immigration? Do you know about this? Why would you? I mean, fucking American history, right? Americans don't know about it. Everywhere I go, I talk about this, and I raise your hand, it's 2 people in every room always. Nobody knows about the quota system. 1924, the law was, there's a number of how many people can come from every country on earth based on an 1880 census, based on how many people there were 2 generations ago, based on the preceding, before this big wave of immigrants from Italy and Eastern Europe and stuff. So it is an overt attempt to reset America the exact color white that it had been, to make it an indisputably white Anglo-Saxon Protestant country. And it, so you get, 5,000 Germans, 3,000 a year for England and Northern Ireland, 100 a year for Albanians, Bulgarians, Greeks, Palestinians, kind of that, Balkans and Near East, 100 a year. And it winds up breaking up families. So for instance, Armenians, who had just been through a genocide, there's this whole, and people, massacres for decades going on in the Ottoman Empire. A lot of them came to the US. They're now stranded. There's no home to go back to. And now their relatives can't get in. There is, in fact, a protest song recorded in 1927 by a guy from Medford, Massachusetts, named Nishan Keljekian. I'll play you that one. It's called Uske Gukas, which means where do you come from in Armenian. And the lyrics, translated by my buddy Harry Kazelian, go, "Oh my America, open the closed door. My fiance is still on the other side. Where did you come up with this quota? Oh my America, are you the only one that doesn't get it? The Armenian language isn't going to harm you. When we start to speak broken Armenian, the melting pot is ready for us. You sent money and missionaries. You made us so porod." You know, porod, slur for Protestant. "Come and be of aid of us. We are not foreign to you." So the door he refers to, open the closed door, is the door from "Keep ancient lands your storied pomp," cries she, "with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. I send these, the homeless, the tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. This is from the second stanza of the poem, The New Colossus, written by the Sephardic Jew Emma Lazarus, and installed at the base of the Statue of Liberty. And that's the story that America tells everybody, and that we tell ourselves about who we are, nation of immigrants. But here in 1927, Nishan Keljekian begs to differ. So, Pekka Granau, Finnish guy, early 70s, says to, for a magazine for, like, nerdy record collectors, hey, guys, I know you're all, like, real into all this, like, rural, dark, hillbilly stuff from the mountains and whatever, and all these, like, loamy blues records of these, you know, singular weirdos, Charlie Pattons and Skip James. You know what you might like, though, really? There's all these records in languages other than English, where I think you're really going to like some of this stuff if you just, you know, check it out. And this librarian guy, Dick Spotswood, sees this article and goes, you know, files it away. Oh, that's interesting, yeah. Foreign records that might be like hillbilly music too. So it turns out a lot of the folks who immigrated to the U.S. were from like rural regions where they themselves could not have possibly recorded in the major urban areas. They would have never been able to make it. Somebody like Nishan Keljekian was from like way in southern Turkey near the Syrian border, a rural guy. Never in a million years would have been able to make it to Istanbul to record. But there he is in Boston area, can make it down to New York City, can make a record for this little independent company that was being run out of a jewelry and watch repair shop on Third Avenue. Here's another record that is exactly, I mean, in another world, these folky guys might have heard this and been like, oh, interesting, that's the kind of thing I like, that's that sound. But you see, the Johnson-Reed Act, the quota system, started in 1924, stayed on the books until 1965, and it did create the most monolingual, monocultural America that had ever existed. So that generation that was born after the Second World War lived in the whitest, the most monocultural America that there ever was. They weren't used to hearing foreign languages, and they were just fixated on this one idea. The door didn't open again until 1965. During that whole period, 1924 to 1965, among the quotas, how many people from all of Asia? Zero. How many people from all of Africa? Zero. Right. So that's the world that these people grew up in, that are, you know, into the Beatles and Dylan and, you know, building the canon, right? So Dick Spotswood listens to Pekka Granow and makes this series of records for the Library of Congress that includes no singer-songwriters, no folk. There's no Woody Guthrie. There's definitely no John Jacob Niles. There's definitely no Judy Collins. None of that stuff. It's just jazz, blues, folk, calypso, stuff from Trinidad, stuff from Hawaii, American Indian stuff. There's a Quaker congregational song. And there's a whole bunch of stuff. About a third of it is recordings by immigrants. It turns out, Granow discovered, that Columbia Records, for instance, one of the two major record companies I mentioned, between 1910 and 1930, they had two major series. The A series, the American series, the pop series, the stuff we all like, American, and the E series, the European series, the ethnic series, the stuff for the immigrants, the foreign stuff. Three-fifths of everything they put out during that time was in a language other than English. More than half of their production during, up until the Depression, was in languages other than English. And for decades, nobody listened to any of it. Nobody paid attention to any of it. As those record collectors went digging for their Bix Beiderbecke and their Fletcher Henderson and their Charlie Patton records, all that foreign stuff they encountered, all those goddamn polkas, goddamn more polka records, over the shoulder, like misshapen fruit. Throw it away. It's junk. Grandma and Grandpa, who were born in 1890 or 1900 or 1910, they start dying in the 60s and 70s, and all that stuff just gets thrown out because nobody is collecting it. Nobody cares. This is a disc that was collected by a guy named Martin Koenig in New York City, who was just buying stuff up in the 60s and 70s. He did see the value of the foreign language material. This is a record made by a guy named Marco Zelazny, who was born March 25th, 1884, in a village called Mikozawa, present-day northeastern Poland, then part of the Russian Empire, arrived in the U.S. July 20th, 1906. 1908 is the single largest year of immigration per capita in U.S. history. Comes through Ellis Island to go to work in anthracite coal mines. In Pennsylvania, there's this really good coal, the best coal. And for generations, the industrialists, the robber barons who ran these coal mines, were employing immigrants who were Welsh, Irish, German, Italian. But in 1902, after a generation or two, those immigrants realized, hey, what the fuck? You're treating us like animals. We're all dying young. How come you're making all the money and we're dying? So they go on strike. It's the first labor activity in U.S. history. And instead of negotiating with them, the management went to the Carpathian Mountains to find some other dumb hillbillies. The intersection between three empires, Prussian, Russian, Austro-Hungarian, Poland, Slovakia, Ukraine. They get this overcrowded, poor population who need the money, and they tell them the story. And the story goes, don't you know about Stanislav? Stanislav came to America, he worked for 3 years, he made enough money, he came back, he bought the house he always wanted, he married the girl, doesn't have to work anymore. You should come. Here, it's $50 for a steamship ticket. Oh, by the way, that's who invented the story, was the steamship companies who were profiting on bringing the people over, right? So they get a bunch of these Slavs over, and they go down into the hole in the ground, in the boiling heat and covered in, you know, and where I grew up, I have a Polish last name, and I heard Polish jokes my whole life growing up, because the idea is Poles are the dumbest people in the world. That's the point of the joke. How many Poles does it take to screw in a light bulb? How many Polacks? And the origin of those jokes is that they were brought over as scabs, as line breakers in these labor disputes, and didn't know it. He's so dumb, he doesn't even know what he's involved in. He doesn't speak the language. He's just going down that hole. What an idiot this guy is, this dumb Polak. My wife's people were all Pennsylvanian coal miners from Slovakia. Still to this day, cabbage rolls and noodles and sour cream is what she refers to as hunky food. Hunky was the American slur for Austro-Hungarian Empire derived. So they were hunkies. Anyway, this is Marko Zelazny. Comes over, as part of these strike breakers. He marries a Polish immigrant woman named Julia